Chancellor Edwin Young, I'm Loris Mayo. We're talking in this office of basketball. She's about to leave. And this is June 21st, 1977. Chancellor Young, I heard from Saul Levine that you were invited back here from Maine by Harrington to be a vice president.
Yes.
I hadn't known that.
Yes.
Did you come at that, or was it?
Yes, I was a vice president for 6 weeks or so.
And what was your view of what you were going to be doing?
Oh, I was going to be helping Mr. Harrington in some legislative and other matters.
Not international programs?
Not particularly,
he
no.
He thought you might be planning to get involved in the
Oh, I would have been, probably, because I'd already been involved. But I would have been sort of a generalist.
And you'll be leaving Bascom early in July?
Yes. Sometime, I suppose, sometime after the 4th.
Many of the people I talked to who have left Bascom, many of the people in the English Department history, have felt very sad. They feel that in the German department, that there's a loss of contact between faculty and students. And do you have any regrets about
leaving Bascom?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I'll never have as fine an office in my life as this one. I like this old building. I like being on the ground floor. I like the student traffic. Mm-hmm. You notice in my office, anybody can just push the door open and come in. They do sometimes. Some people are rather under, but I see a lot of people. And one of the things about the new job is I will be removed from faculty and student contacts.
Yeah.
But 9 years is long enough, and I think, and I think the fact the place deserves some change. And I would have been retiring in a couple of years anyway.
Yes. Yes. Well, I really want to talk about the TAA,
yes.
And I guess my first sort of overall question is how much of your energy, emotional energy, time, thought over your period as chancellor has been, what percentage has been devoted to the problems having to do with the TAA and TAs?
Oh, relatively small, maybe 4 or 5%. Short periods of time I've had to be concerned. I was concerned at the time it was organized and at the time of the strike, but outside of that I haven't paid very much attention. I've met with them on a number of occasions, and 5 or 6 months ago I met with a group from the TA. But the actual bargaining has been carried on by other people, the administration of the contract, and I don't second guess what they do. In fact, often I don't know. The assumption of the TA has been that I'm very deeply involved, but really have not been. That be beyond certain critical times. I was very concerned at the time of the strike, as anybody would be.
When you came, the Mulvihill report was, let's see, it must have been just about finished at that
time. I believe so, yes.
Were you aware of it?
Yes, and was concerned that we weren't implementing it, because I think that I don't believe the implementation of it would have deterred an attempted organization, but I think it would have provided less support, because it did point out some things that needed correction, and nobody did anything about it till we had the organization.
Well, why not?
Well, the faculty thinks in long time spans that we'll get around to it. That they're going to be here the rest of their lives. The TAs, of course, think in much shorter span. Students do. I think it's the nature. One of the good things about a university is the longer view. And that's what. But for impatient people, this gets very annoying.
And you presumably had no authority to push it
on? No, no. It was a report I suppose if I'd made that my major activity. But remember, I came in the middle of a very serious and rough period, and I had a lot of other things to do. Yes. Keeping the place open.
What has been your own view of what faculty contact powers of the percentage that students should have. You know, Dave Cronin signed a statement saying he thought 2/3 of faculty contact hours should be with full-time faculty.
Yes, well, that seems a reasonable number. And actually, I suspect it's that now. But you see, it depends on how you do the counting. The TA has one way of counting, but if you take the total number of hours, you can get different results, you see.
Yes, I do know that. I hoped I had worded it right, but maybe I have.
Yes, well, anyway, on the other hand, I think there's another side to it, and that is that you can't have a uniform rule. One of the interesting things that's going on now is the discussion of laying off tenured faculty in some of the universities. We aren't going to be faced with that problem in Madison, partly because when there was a sudden bulge, we were able to use TAs. Now we can increase and decrease the numbers. So it serves so over time, I think that we're likely to decrease somewhat as we get stabilized. To rush out and hire a lot of people in a poor market wouldn't have been very wise, wouldn't have been very good for the students either. Of course, my own view is that properly supervised TA instruction can be very good instruction. But I would say of the credit hours that a student takes, I'd say 2/3 ought to be from senior people. I'd personally use student as credit hours rather than contact hours, because some of those contact hours are kind of discussion groups in small or drills in language or labs, and a lot of different ways of saying. But I'd say 2/3 of the credit ought to be taught by senior people, probably. No magic about it. In some fields, some students get almost 100%, and others take courses. One time I had a group of students in, radical students, demanding that there be more small classes, that we take more minority students, and we have a smaller population in the university, which of course finds the demands. And so I said to them, well, now, look, there's the print, because we have it on all these small classes. Why don't you take those? Why are you fussing about these big classes for? Oh, well, it's harder if you take small classes because the professor knows what you're doing. So we take the big ones to avoid the hard work. So, you know, this kind of criticism is kind of silly. So I don't pay as much attention to some of that. I think some people teach superbly in large classes. Harvey Goldberger was, you know, an idol of the radical kids a few years ago. He gets turned on with a big crowd. My professor, Selig Perlman, was one of the greatest the greatest of labor historians. He didn't get going unless there were 100 people in front of him. And he was tremendous. And he was, you know, voted very high, one of the most popular teachers in those days. They elected outstanding teachers. Other people could only teach with a handful. Veblen couldn't, no more than a dozen people could hear him. So you get all kinds of situations, and so we need to think through what the course is, what is trying to be achieved, and more than any arbitrary numbers, I think. It's possible to hire full-time faculty to teach elementary languages, math.
No.
You see, on the other hand, and probably not to run labs, the routine beginning labs. And so I'd rather actually than take a number, go at it from the point of view of what does the person do. I'm also very concerned that some people don't properly supervise, and by supervise I really mean help the TA. There's some knacks to the trade. One ought to meet with TAs, and they ought to have a hand in not from the point of view of authority, but from the point of view of good management, of discuss with the professor what is being taught, what the objectives are, make suggestions.
That's one of the things that was missing in the 60s for many.
Yes. Now, I was a TA And then I had I taught courses of 400 students, and I had lots of TAs, and had great respect for their abilities and their contribution, but it was necessary to meet with them and advise them. There's some tricks to the trade of teaching. How do you handle a class? How do you keep one person from dominating the discussion section? And all these little things make sure that people are on the come, and that the discussion isn't a repetition of the lecture or a repetition of the textbook and so on.
Yes, well, of course, if the purpose of the TA as a faculty client is to train teachers, why would obviously...
Yes. But I don't like the suggestion that was put forward to me recently by somebody who came in demanding why... The former head of the TAs, he now works for a radio station, came to interview me. Wasn't it criminal, he didn't say criminal, some other word, that the university didn't require TAs and professors to take courses in pedagogy in the School of Education? Well, you know, I don't agree with that, but I do agree that they need some help from master teachers.
Well, were you aware that there was a TAA on campus at the time you came?
I don't know. I don't recall.
Small.
Yes, I don't recall what the organization. But I wouldn't have been surprised at it, because I remember the TAA formed had two roles. One was to try to be a traditional trade union, but it was also a radical organization to support radical activities. And, and it always was working both sides.
Well, the trade union side didn't come on quite a
while. Well, not open. They claimed to be it, but they didn't really do much about it. But they were really, and so it was another vehicle for organizing some demonstrations and so on, and supporting radical activities.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Shabazz proposal, when it exploded on the scene, when did you know about that? Do you remember how you heard about it?
That was to what?
That was in the out-of-state tuition for graduate students should not be remitted.
I probably didn't know about it in advance. Very unlikely that I would have, but I don't recall.
But you would have happened to me,
probably. Yeah, well, of course, if I were around, yes.
Well, so what did you...
What's my reaction?
What did you do about it?
I guess I've forgotten. I suppose I tried to... I don't remember what I did, but what I would have been likely to have done is to have tried to get some estimate of how effective it was going to be, and then try to get some lobbying behind the scenes to make sure it was killed. This is my typical way. See, I don't go out in the papers and denounce people usually. If somebody asked me, I would say that I thought it would be very wrong, but I normally don't just grab the headlines. I would more likely go down and talk to two or three knowledgeable people around the legislature and say, no, how serious is this?
Did you?
I can't recall what I did. You know, by the way, you might find out by talking to Jerry Inkle or looking at, but there's, things were moving so fast. I had so many things going on. I was dealing with police departments and National Guard, and there were a lot of things besides. See, the TA looms large to you because it's what you're working on, but to me, it was just one thing.
Yeah, as I say, it exploded on the scene
from
the point of view of the TAA, but for you, it was just...
It was one more.
Interesting, because I really did think that you would have... you would have remembered it more. It seems everybody says that's how it began.
Yes. Well, you see, I've had a lot of things laid on top of that.
Yes, okay. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, then do you remember the first meeting when Hank Hazak and Bob Mellencamp came to your office with some union leaders?
Oh, you mean from the labor...
Glenn Van Kieran and Tom King and Dick Hickson?
Well, I knew that the group came, but I don't remember much about it. And a number of occasions they brought people in. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't remember much details. The date would probably be in the calendar that they made an appointment. But I wasn't...
But it didn't make an impression on you?
It made some impression, of course. The thing that I was aware of all through this, and this is, I guess I can say now, I haven't told people this, I was operating some kind of a strategy, you probably guessed. I don't know if you can figure it out what it was. I wasn't concerned about the TAs. I was concerned with our continued relation with the rest of the labor movement. And so in my dealings with the TAs, I always had to act very carefully that I didn't appear to be anti-labor. Mm-hmm. See, I had been, from the time I was got my PhD here, or even before, I'd worked with the labor movement. I was director of the School for Workers. So, that was an emergency thing just to fill in until we found somebody. I had been on the university's labor management committee as a management member for years. And we had, even before there was a union, before the state recognized unions, very good working relations with our unions, and it still goes on, as you probably know. Tom King and I are friends, by the way.
Yes.
And I didn't want to jeopardize that. So if they brought labor people in, at that time I didn't know Tom King. He was, I don't know what he was, what union he represented, but I knew a lot of labor people. So my whole concern throughout this whole thing was the relations with the labor movement. The TAs couldn't do anything to us. I beat them in that. See, I could have killed them off at the strike. They were beaten at the end. But Alan and Christensen and other people said, "Well, you know, let's not push them too hard." And I went along with it. But they came in. They caved, and I do believe that people who have a right to organize if they want to. I argue against faculty doing it because I think faculty governance is better than any union contract. But the TAs never had faculty governance, and I never gave it to them, you see. And so I always had a different feeling about them and their right to. And I knew about the Mulvey Hill report and felt, and I knew there were some real grievances as well as the radical activities. So I had a good deal of sympathy for the TA throughout all this, even though I had to be fairly tough in my official relationship with them because some of them were using it for other purposes. But it was kind of a mixed thing with me. So I would have been very, at the time, whatever, I don't remember the particular episode, but I would have treated them more seriously, I would say, because I was really dealing with the other labor people. I knew, for instance, that if I took a very anti-labor stand, the pressure that the TAs were putting on the labor people to observe their picket lines would have been more fruitful. So that was the game from all along was not to let our TA thing damage our relationship with bona fide trade unions. I never can consider a student union a bona fide trade union for this reason, that the turnover is such that the people you're dealing with across the table have no investment in the future. I don't think collective bargaining works if neither the employer or the employees aren't going to be there in the future. And we go through this with MULO, this charade of bargaining. Well, now they've got to build the legislature, what's this local Jack Clarenbach, to force us to bargain on wages with MULO. Well, that's fine for his student constituency, but it's a damn poor policy for state. And the reason is there's no continuity to them. You get one thing worked out with one group. For instance, we had one president of the TAA whose wife was pregnant, so she wanted a doctor of her own choosing. I was trying to provide them with a much better health service, but no, they had to have insurance so she could have a doctor of her own choice. And the next year they said, "Well, why didn't you give us why can't we use the student health service, which they tried to give them the year before?" You see, it's this kind of lack of continuity.
Yeah.
But so be it. It's part of their education too.
Does anybody say this to them?
They don't pay attention, of course. No point in saying to Hank Haslick, he's been here longer than I have.
That's true. Yeah.
but by and large. And of course, I suppose one has to say, well, what is their alternative? You see, what is the alternative? Because the faculty hadn't acted earlier. But take the TAs now. As near as I can tell, the reason the English department gave up teaching composition was because the TAs refused to do it. They wanted to teach revolutionary literature, not all of them, you know. And by the way, there's always, when we talk about these groups, I'm talking about the activist ones, which
yes,
is,
I know.
And not the great bulk. So the English department stopped teaching composition. Now the TAs are the ones who are demanding, they're outraged, they want to appear before the regents. and the demand that we teach it ought to provide jobs for TAs. And it's got to be done, but they were the ones who killed it.
Incidentally, were you very alarmed when that happened, when the English department canceled the competition?
Well, if they couldn't control the TAs, there wasn't much point, you see. After all, if they were using the classes to kind of, at least some of them, to discuss, you know, talk about literary people. I know I'm concerned. I happen to believe that reading and writing are the most important things we do around here.
I know you're getting it started again.
Well, I've always felt that way. See, I'm really quite a fundamentalist. I think if anyone knows some fundamentals of science and writing, and I don't believe you can write without writing. I think you have one. In fact, my writing isn't as good as it was when I graduated from college, because I was writing a lot. You see, one has to do it a lot. A dictating machine isn't a very good device for writing. If I care about a letter, I write it out in longhand. Under our system, that's the English department's decision. I was bothered by it, but I couldn't. I don't really believe that a chancellor can second guess a department in our structure. And even when I may not believe privately that they're wrong, because actually, most of the time, I have great confidence in departmental systems, the larger departments particularly. Some of the small ones get one or two people and they go a little haywire sometimes, I think. But a large department, people involved with the subject. Part of it, of course, is that the English people, they're literary people. And we were asking to do high school work, you see. That's the problem with it. It's a contradiction. We have the same thing in the beginning math now. We have it in the beginning languages. We never will have, this is why the TAs, at least in schools where they don't have TAs and they hire lecturers. Well, we've got a couple of our very bitter women around here on the staff are people who've been lecturers in teaching beginning languages for years. They want to be professors, treated like professors after all, you see. And so it's a very serious problem.
Yes, I know, it's a type.
So how one gets at it, see, in the long run, we ought to get it back in the secondary schools.
Could you do anything about that?
I think public pressure will do it.
But can you help with the law?
Oh, we'll pressure it from here as much as we can, but in the meantime, we have to do some remedial work. But I'll pressure it, I'll talk about it, and we'll get around the state. But I can't put myself in the position of saying, well, I know how to run the public schools. I may not run the university very well, but I run public schools. Because, I blame the public for what's happened. That when you pressure the teachers to teach so much human relations and social adjustment and not have everybody pass and all the things that our public has done to the schools, then my children come home from West High School talking about the economics they're learning in social science and make them weep. As an economist, you know, it just makes you weep because they're not talking about anything that's important at all. It's like some of the environmentalists, you know, they just get carried away with anything that affects the environment. It's all equal. Well, I don't think that view. You're getting a lot of opinions today which perhaps don't pertain to this closely.
Okay, that was one of the first questions I asked you. But I would like to know, you say you were concerned with your relations with the unions.
Yes.
What about your relations with the faculty?
I was concerned with that too. And that's why we tried to get some faculty involved. And if you'll notice, the faculty, many of them were critical of me.
Yes.
But they hadn't solved the problem, and I had to face the problem. I had to make a decision, and I made it. And I don't regret the decision I made. At that time, the law was no clear law. Later on, if it had come up some years later after the law was clarified, I wouldn't have recognized the union. But at the time, it seemed that the faculty position, by and large, They weren't willing to do very much.
Yes, you're right. You could say, well, you didn't. You had your chance with Mulgrew. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and the faculty didn't stand up and speak against the TAAs very much. A few did.
Yeah.
The faculty got excited when, as I would, and I, you know, and I consider myself a faculty member, when they want to take over running the classes. the faculty really didn't care very much how hard they pressed the administration on money or hours, things like that, as long as it didn't annoy the faculty.
They're very split, I know.
Yeah, on that. So I had to use my, but the thing that I did know, that I had so much faculty support that they were willing to let me make some mistakes. I have done things all the time I've been chancellor, which different groups of faculty have disapproved of at different times. But taken on the whole, I've had very strong backing. And so they say, well, you know, you're soft-headed about that, but on the whole. And so I could get away with it. And the other side of it, you know, is nobody wanted the job anyway.
You did consult with faculty then.
Oh, yes.
This group came, as I understand, 1 week, and you said, no, I won't recognize you. And then a week passed, and then you called up Muhlenkamp and said, yeah, come on over. I'm not sure if that answers
I thought it over and discussed it with a number of people, but I really made up my own mind. That was my decision, mm-hmm. and nobody else should be blamed for it. I thought about it a good deal, and see, the thing that bothered me about it was that when we have a law, national policy, that people have a right to organize and bargain through representatives of their own choosing. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I didn't have to recognize them. And if I'd said yes at that day, I would have no choice. Saying no, I knew it could go the other way. So if somebody's pushing for something, you can say no and buy some time. But if you say yes, you're finished. So that's probably what I would, but I don't, but you see, I don't have that kind of memory.
Okay, that's all right.
And I don't believe most people do. Some people speak as if they had it all, remembered everything, but they don't really.
Were there regents did you have to worry about what they might say?
Oh, I didn't worry too much about it, because if we had consulted the regents, they're quite conservative. Well, if I'd asked them to do it, they wouldn't have done it, probably. But again, they needed me then.
Yeah, I see. That's right.
Yes, you know, I've been able to have my own way about a number of things.
On in the structure agreement, mm-hmm. the main issue was the right to strike.
Yes.
And there's a lot of fuzziness there.
Yeah,
wasn't there?
Yeah.
And your understanding was that there wasn't a right to strike.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of around the corner. Yeah. Because Feinsinger has written an article, you probably have seen about all this. It says that the administration knew that really that there was a right to strike in finance.
No, that's not true.
Quoting it quite fairly.
No.
Or a right to strike on non-bargaining issues. That is, that they were just confined by the state law as to...
That's his interpretation of the law, but I never took that interpretation. See, I refused to accept that interpretation. I heard that argument, but that meant that you could have a strike any time, you could just trump up some other reason. Mm-hmm. See, they could say that they had a right to... They used to argue that they, as long as they weren't striking on what we were bargaining about, they could strike in support of against the war, they could strike for this, or whatever group was demonstrating or something. And I just said, hell with that.
As far as you were concerned?
No. Yeah. If you made a study of various public employers in the state of Wisconsin who have had strikes, who was the toughest one? There's a school, that, you know, what the case 2 or 3 years, Ortonville. Mm. The school board and I think are the two ones that made it stick. No strength.
Did you you consulted Jim Stern?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you know Mark Heavy?
Yes, slightly. I got to know him quite, he was a student of Jim's.
Yes.
Very able person. Mm-hmm. But determined to raise hell.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Hank has, I'd be interested in what you thought of them as people to deal with.
Oh, I didn't like dealing with them as people to deal with. See, because they weren't really interested in trade unionism. See, it wasn't real collective bargaining. It was dealing with a radical group. It was using the guise of collective bargaining and I had to go through the format of it, but really what, we weren't doing that. What they were concerned about was other things, really, at that time.
That's true, of course. And,
And they were using the trade union movement, you see. I don't know what Marchetti is doing now, but I suspect he's been fired lately.
I bet he's been fired. Yesterday saw an interview with him. He's been working in a mine.
Mm-hmm. But he worked for the union. He got fired from that.
Yes.
I think. See, yeah. Because it's his nature, I think, to try to use the union to organize for other. And this is a standard operating procedure. It's going on all over the country now. It's reminiscent of the 30s and 50s of the cycles. The radicals will be in school and they'll try to get something going and organize a revolution. Can't get it go there. Then they read their text with some version of Marxism, old, that it really had to organize the workers. And then they were being exploited, and you know they are being terribly exploited. But they don't know it, and so they join the unions, and then they get very active in the committees. They volunteer, and then they try to take over. It won't work. But they're giving right now all over the country. They're giving the unions a lot of difficulty.
This group.
You see, all out of proportion to their numbers, because they go to all the meetings. They wait. You know, everybody else goes home. They're still there. It's a standard procedure, but it won't succeed because after a while they'll get thrown. They'll throw them out again. But this has gone on, and it will happen to the Marchettis of this world, and just as regularly in the Haslicks. Of course, Haslick hasn't really gotten into a real union, but
Some of these people stayed in the academic.
Yes.
They have become quite respectable.
Yes.
Probably in a way, Catholic.
Well, very respectable.
In a way. Not entirely.
What's he doing?
He's teaching minority groups or underprivileged. The engineering school is teaching them math, remedial math.
Oh, God Almighty. Why is it they keep hiring him and hiring me? You see, under the agreement, he's only supposed to be here 5 years on the payroll.
He's since 1965.
Yes.
He hasn't finished his PhD.
No.
He's still working.
Well, I wish him no. As long as he stays away from me, I have no concern. But I could. You see, I can never regard him as a trade unionist in the real sense of it.
No, that's right. He didn't regard himself.
No, it was a vehicle for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But their and this accounts for their abusive language. Now, Jim Stern said that it was perfectly normal to use expressions like the cuirass and all that sort of thing. But Captain Cobley said, who's also had bargaining experience, that it was absolutely out of the question of union bargaining. Now what?
Well, they're much worse than the unions. Some union people do this, but it isn't taught very well. Most don't.
Hmm.
But there are some who are quite profane. Profanity is much more. And vulgarity too,
yeah.
But not the mean bitterness, the personal attacks that see these people. And they would pound on the table and act. They did behave outrageously.
Well, now I thought so, and certainly all the faculty I talked to.
Yeah. By the way, one of the interesting things, in some ways, if I hadn't had the TAA, I should have invented them. Because there's nothing has inoculated our faculty so much against unionism as the TAs, because some of them insist their own experience with them, and they think that's what unions are like. Well, it's not true. It isn't fair to unions, because they're not like that. But if you were really wanted to inoculate...
We better take that part off the tank.
Oh, I don't care.
Just joking.
Well, people don't take it too seriously.
Jim Stewart said that this wouldn't bother people. And I told him that the faculty...
Well, look, I can tell you something, that recently some of the state people are quite bothered by some of the abusive language they've had from the Public Employees Union, which is a little bit, they've been acting a little similar.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who are used to a lot of bargaining. They don't like it. They really are very upset by it. It's a form of harassment and insult.
Yeah. Well, Ed Prinsky said that if he had known But he was over that sort of thing. He might not have taken the job.
Yes. And he's had a lot of experience as a mediator, you see. I've been a mediator, arbitrator, I've been around collective bargaining a lot. Did nothing like, because I never dealt much with the TAs.
No, but some.
Mm-hmm.
Bucklew was suggested, like Jim Stern says, he said he suggested him. Mm-hmm. Did you, the TAs didn't like him very well?
No. They didn't like anybody who didn't agree with them.
How did you, did he keep in as close touch with faculty members in the dean's office as Ed Prinsky did, do you know?
I think he kept in touch with some people, but I don't know how much. He wasn't here a very long time, but he kept some contact. We always were very much aware of the fact that we had to have faculty support. Mm-hmm. And even if it was grudging sometimes. And involvement with the deans. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Bob Doremus could tell you how much, because he was LNS was the principal.
Yeah. Because, well, we didn't think of asking him then. I talked to him again.
By the way, he has a very good memory.
Yes.
And this is one of the sharpest minds in the university, Bob Doremus's. They know him. Anybody who gets straight A's in physics major at Harvard is pretty good.
That's right. Yes, one of the important things to do with this job is to go back and talk to people after you talk to them.
Sure, and yes.
But why was Christensen there? If Bucklew was because Prinsky didn't have the...
But Christensen was the person who... was working for me as my lawyer and had some collective bargaining experience. I guess the only thing I'd say about Ireland is he's so patient and wants to believe that everybody's good and has good intentions, and that's where we went farther than we should have gone. Alan Christensen. He's just he's what, if it weren't these, what, 20 years ago would have been called a Christian. But he's a very nice person, and he really believes that, you see, he wanted to believe that they really were good intentioned. I knew better. I knew what they were up to. I knew.
In fact, he said that. He kept hoping.
Yes.
He had a lot of invested in making an agreement. He said,
yes.
So did you, was saying, you don't necessarily win just because you get an agreement.
Yes.
Yeah. But Doremus, in fact, thought that he was a better bargain than Buckley was.
I don't know. I don't know. But you see, Christensen gave away, set the first framework. At least he got on better with the TAs, because they could see that he was so eager to have an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think this is, anytime you get yourself in the frame of mind that you've got to have an agreement, you've lost part of the collective bargaining. You've got to believe that you can only pay a certain price for an agreement, and that you won't, beyond that you won't go. Otherwise, you start giving it away. I've watched quite a bit of this stuff. It's like, you know, people say there's nothing as bad as war. Well, there are worse things than war. You know, some people in Uganda are dying because they can't stand that character. It's better to die than be slaves. And it's like collective bargaining. Lots of things are worse to give away, to let a company go bankrupt in order to prevent a strike, or to the state service to make it impossible to manage it. But you have to have that frame of mind, you see, and I think Ireland didn't really want to believe that.
But he's a bargainer himself.
Since then he's done. Yes, he's done some. Yeah, but he's always dealing with people. You see, who wanted to settle.
Yeah.
You see, but that was the other side of it. These people wanted. Well, if Aslak and had his way, there would be a continuous strike. You see.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference. Now I had an advantage that some of these other people didn't have. I had studied labor history And it had these radical kids in my classes over the years. And I knew them quite well. When I was an undergraduate in Maine, I was president of what we call a liberal club there, which is kind of a somewhat left of center in Maine, very far left. And the communists tried to take it over. So I dealt with them, you see. I dealt with them here when, in 45, when I was a graduate student, I watched them try to take over the veterans' organizations. I've seen this game played. Now, I'm not saying Hasluck is a communist, but the tactics are the same. Yeah. Where the objective is disruption, not settlement. Mm-hmm. So, see, all Ireland's experience has been with people who want the firm to continue. And they want the settlement. Like the state employees, they want a settlement. Now, they're probably, I would guess there's a few of the people who don't, because there's some of these same people who have taken jobs and they're in that union now. But the great bulk of those employees want a settlement. And Tom King knows that, and so that's the group he has to respond to. But Ireland was dealing with people who didn't want a settlement. If they would have wanted to accept on such terms, they would have raised the ante every time.
Yeah. Yes. Jerry said that Hank Hasluck's face lighted up
I became
evident that
they
could go on strike.
Yes, obviously.
But Arlen Christensen did say that it was unusually difficult to bargain. Now, maybe you covered that in what you just said, but what his point was that there was no central decision making. In other words, you couldn't just say right off the bat, okay or not, but you had to consult all sorts of people.
Me? From my side, you mean from the other
side? From your side.
Oh.
I mean, he couldn't call you up and say, shall we do this, and you couldn't immediately say yes or no. You'd have to say, well, what will it happily be? What will it be? Is that?
Well, it's just some of that, but that's a way of slowing it down, too. There's a mixture. The regions could have overruled me, so I had to feel my way along a bit. But some of it, one of the other things in collective bargaining, see, the union always says we got to go back to the membership.
Yeah.
That gives them a second crack at it. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't I do the same? The fellow up front was at the table should never be allowed to really, right off the top of his head, make a commitment. Because there's no way of taking it back, you see. So when you say, come back, we got to talk it over, and let's look at it. Gives you a second crack at it. The union always does that.
See, so he had two stages. He could go to you, and you could go to somebody else.
Yeah. And on the other hand, I had to keep them reluctantly with me. You see, I did have my politicking to do. See, if I had, I can imagine what it was. See, if I were to make some serious concession, which would have the regions for approval, much better to get the approval in advance than confront them with it.
The regions?
Yeah, or something. You know.
Oh, I see. So you called them as well?
Well, I suppose on one or two of these things, yes, or maybe the president of the board, something. So that he could say, well, he'd been informed or something like that. Now, they weren't very happy about this, but at least I had none of the faculty, you know, I had to carry constituency with me. But there's two reasons not giving him authority. One was I had to carry the constituents, but the other one was I didn't want him to give it away. I mean, I didn't want him to get caught. See, saying, well, I'm making a mistake of misunderstanding, because they would never, when you're dealing with a union across the table, anything you concede, you never can get back. So a combination of two things, I suspect.
Would the regents, would they possibly also be saying, we'll make these statements for the public that we're opposed to, but really we'll follow along with whatever the chancellor?
No. I don't think so. They never said that. They gave me a good deal of support on things they didn't believe in, but they never made a statement like that, I don't think.
I don't mean make it. I mean, would they do it? Would that be a way of operating?
Well, you see, the regents, there's many different ways as there are regents. That they were never, see, the regents are never cohesive. They don't see much of each other. people almost think of them as a block, but it's the most divided group of people. So they come together once a month. Now, some of them get on the phone and talk to each other at that period more than now. But see, they're very conscious of public meeting law. These regions, if we have a cocktail party at my house, they won't come to any conclusion about it. If they discuss anything, they wouldn't come to a conclusion. They're not going to get caught obeying the law. It's very awkward. They're really very, in private, they're very meticulous about being legal, which is good. I mean, as long as you have the law, I think they have to be.
And you also said that you were slowing things down.
It slows down making an instant decision, in a sense, coming back. It gives you time to think about it.
Yeah, but I meant in the sense that before the party started sometime in May or June, mm-hmm. went all the way through to January. Mm-hmm. Now, was this deliberate?
No, it was because they're impossible demands. Mm. So, you know, the demands are impossible. They were designed to be unacceptable.
Jim Stern said that he felt your faculty advisors were much more conservative than the larger body of the faculty, and that they, the faculty, in fact, would be willing to go to make more concessions than
I don't think so. I think that the ones who were talking would. But if you, it's like the Senate. I've been presiding over the Senate for all these years. There's a group that does a lot of talking, and they're much more liberal. But sitting over there is a great number of people who don't agree with it, and they don't say anything. But they're there, and they're the people who keep, you know, very important people to me. They're much more important than some of the people who do a lot of talking, you know. Whether Anatole Beck agrees with me or not really doesn't bother me very much. But to have a very senior scientist in the College of Agriculture who's a world figure unhappy, that makes a difference. So I think I'm probably better, I have great affection and respect for Jim Stern, as you know, but I think I'm a better judge of faculty than the sentiment.
Well, what he said was that he called you up about the last week, just towards the end, and said that you weren't going far enough. They were making concessions, for instance, giving the TAs a four-year appointment instead of one, mm-hmm. and some other things. And I think he came over and talked to you.
Probably.
You don't remember that.
No, but you see, I saw so many people coming and going on about so many issues that I wouldn't remember which ones.
So from your point of view, this wasn't a turning point.
It's coming over?
This turning point, yeah.
I can't recall that he's coming and talking to me.
Yeah.
I would have always listened carefully to Jim. I have great respect for his judgment. I think I've always had one doubt, though. I think he's so committed to collective bargaining that when in doubt, he would have an agreement, and he would go further than I would. For instance, he's not as concerned about faculty collective bargaining as I am, probably. Mm-hmm. But because he's so devoted to it, you know, and he sees it as another realm. But I'm such a traditionalist about the university governance. See, remember, Jim had come out of it hadn't long been out of the auto workers.
Yeah. Yes, I realized when I talked.
But you know why Jim?
A very different point of view from the ordinary faculty.
Yes. Very different, you see. Well, and so we were looking for somebody in the department. And Elizabeth Brandeis said, I was on a program in Milwaukee with a young man from the auto workers named Stern. We ought to get him. Well, it was very unusual to hire people out of unions, most at faculty level. So I discovered, I got some papers about him, discovered he was going to be speaking to a union group up Portage or someplace, wherever. So I drove up and sat in the audience and listened. And he did such a tremendous job of explaining the Luther position. But then he said, now I want you to know that that's the official position. I don't, as an economist, I don't agree with it altogether. No. He said, well, what don't you agree with? And he explained very carefully, and he presented it so fairly and so well. I said, we've got to get this man.
Was he a PhD?
Yes.
He was a scholar.
Oh, from Berkeley. Yes, a PhD from Berkeley.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a great respect for his analytical ability. I've always saw him, but on the faculty, I think I have a better sense. Maybe I did then. Maybe I've lost it now. I've been up in here so long, but I think that's my stock in trade. You know, after all, getting along with the faculty is fishing with a weak line.
Well, were you then holding these things off? What Feinzinger said was that you always kept some things in your back pocket that you could give in on at the last minute.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, this is so normal for bargaining that, you know, yeah. I see. If you put everything out front, there's nothing to settle with. But see, the union always takes everything you offer, and then the bargain goes on from there. But then you can carry it to ridiculous things, and you'll have to be a little careful with some of this stuff when you edit it, I hope. But take the local situations going on in state. Tom King's making a lot of propaganda out of, they're giving the unrepresented employees 7% and the state offers 2%. See, the state is only offering the state employees 2%. Now, nobody took that seriously, but they shouldn't have done it. See, it's offering so little so they can give more. They should have offered something, I think. So you don't owe back everything. You make some reasonable offer, but you have to have something back if you're going to settle.
Yeah, I see. That's right. In 1976, the dean's office wanted a class size of 28. And that would have been out of the question for you to offer that.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been outrageous.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know, a lot of this isn't very calculated. You know, I don't.
Well, it's your nature, or your training.
Well, I just do it off the top of my head usually. I'm not a very calculating person. And people think I am. You know, I've got a reputation for being a little, almost some people would go so far as say devious, because they can't figure out what I'm up to, because I don't have them figured it out myself, you see, and so there's no way of predicting what I'm going to do.
I haven't heard the word devious.
Well,
everybody, the expression always is, keeps things close to his chest.
That's exactly the opposite, you see. But you know how to hide things? Hmm? If you want to hide something, where do you put it?
Well, it depends on where you use
it. Well, often, if you put it right out in the middle of the room, nobody sees it. Yes, you see. So I don't hide it. They think I do, but I don't really.
Well, so you weren't upset then by the prospect of a strike?
Well, I didn't want a strike, but I thought a strike was much better than giving away the shop. See, that's what the decision was. I didn't want to see, because you know, it didn't know where the strike was going to lead to.
Well, that's what I would like to know, what you did foresee.
Well, what I saw is I calculated. Now, this is the way I would normally behave on these things, so I assume I did at the time. I would look at it this way, and I'm sure that these developers, if there's a strike, will the rest of the... See, I didn't worry about the TAs. I worried about the other unions. Were they on the picket lines? That's the issue. Therefore, in the behavior with the TAs, I had to act reasonable. But as long as I acted reasonable, and we did, we made concessions and probably shouldn't have made, and as long as I acted that way, and then there was a strike, I thought the labor movement would, the other people, they didn't like the TAs. The traditional trade unionist is a fairly conservative person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, see. Now, and, I know that when they go and talk to certain leaders, they'll get some words, but my lines to the labor people were better than the TA's lines.
Did you call labor people up and ask them what they were going to do?
No, you wouldn't call them and ask them what they're going to do. That's unfair. Mm. You try to guess. Mm. The best evidence you can get your hands on. Sometimes my evidence.
How many times did you work to craft the phrase? Both of you and the union were working terribly hard on the state of the various unions.
Well, some of my people were working with them, I suspect. Mm. Yes, I can't believe they weren't. I had some conversations, but I wouldn't call up and say, are you going to do it or not? I would be more likely to call up and say, well, Joe, I understand you're under pressure from the TA, you know, and maybe you'd like to hear my side of it. Mm-hmm. And that other conversation, I would probably come to some conclusion. Mm-hmm. And it's conceivable we might have had, but it's dangerous to ask that question, because for a labor person to say we won't honor picket lines is a pretty hard thing to say. What you have to do is estimate what they're going to do by your own, what you know about it. And so, people can't push me around, can push me only so far. See, I'd rather lose a strike than be the one who gave away the governance of the university. And so, but you never know on a strike what's going to happen. There's too many variables. See, somebody might have got killed. They fired a gun into the chemistry tank of chemicals. They did some other things. Other things happened at the same time. They didn't deny doing them. They wouldn't admit it, some of the things. But so, later on, some of the leaders went to Minneapolis to talk to the people up there, and they said that the thing they should have done is use more violence. They should have used more violence. They had us on the run. They didn't understand me very well. It's like this.
You would have tightened up.
Yeah. Actually, now it's like these kids who came in the other day were going to take over the office and barricade the doors and sit in. I wouldn't let them. You know, I just stood and held the door myself. Three of them couldn't move me. I maybe almost a little irrational, but I'm stubborn. And so this limit I wouldn't go. And see, this is why I was useful in these years when people wanted to close the place down. I just said, well, we'll close it down. Don't give a damn for anybody.
That reminds me of a question as to how much of your concern had to do with stopping of deliveries for research, that is the Teamsters were mm-hmm. Well, to begin with, what about the Teamsters?
What about them?
Well, the fact that they did support them.
Yes. Well, we couldn't. I wasn't very happy about it. But there was a split, see, in the Teamsters union. Mm-hmm. And so we had a sort of radical fringe here. Marquette had been working with them. And got support, and it was a way for them to show their muscle. But when we stopped paying, the bus drivers didn't get paid. They got tired of that. They react against the leadership.
Did you hear the rumor that the TAs paid the bus drivers during the period that they weren't striking?
No, I never heard that. I wouldn't be surprised if they tried it, but they didn't have resources to do it very long.
It must be.
I'd be interested in that, because it could have happened. I used to go out on the picket line. This was what drove the TAs wild when I went out.
Nice picture.
Visit talking with the pickets, you see, and I can be fairly persuasive, you know, whenever I raise questions with them and about what do you know what they're saying and so on, and just all I do, that just upset the leadership terribly.
And what sort of reception did the TA that you talked to give you?
Oh, they were always very,
But they're a wonderful bunch of people. You know,
yes, that's the thing, you see. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. Around the state, they were always being sympathetic. Some people wanted to even get legislation to outlaw having TAs.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's completely the wrong thing. And I always knew that, too, you see. I knew what the average TA was like. And I knew how they were being torn, whether to support their leadership, which they didn't agree with, and out of loyalty, you see.
Yes, that's true.
It was a terrible spot they were in.
Mm-hmm.
I understood it.
And, of course, a marvelous experience for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing.
Now, some of them thought that we would use keep lists of people who did what and write letters and so on, jobs and things. And we never kept any list. I've never allowed any list to be kept of any student whoever disrupted or did anything here. Well, I've never kept it.
I mean, some of the faculty.
The individual faculty members might, but most of them wouldn't.
Yeah.
But the TAs had some view that we would. They always wanted to bargain about this, you know. But we had to write only favorable letters, which, of course, all you have to do is send along with the letter a copy of the agreement. That would make the letter worthless.
Yeah.
We never did it, but you know, the radicals all thought that we kept the dossiers on them. The only place you can find anything about them down in the Cardinal files. The names are there.
Well, I was thinking of the rank and file TAs.
Yes.
I interviewed a couple of women, and it was a really great period in their lives.
Yeah. And, yes. Well, you see, we made it easy. You could come here. This is what the university is about, and I encourage it. It's a place where you can be radical and do crazy things and go away and start all over again. And this is one of the reasons why I never want to keep record. When I used to appear before the legislative committees, they'd wonder how many we expel lately, you know, as undergraduates. And I'd always say, well, you know, we're really trying to graduate them, and that's our business. And I'd fuss it up a little bit, and we've got some investigations going. But, you know, we never did much around here all that period or two. That really would later damage a student. The only thing that once they get arrested, then they get records. There's no way of preventing that. But I've tried so hard to keep students from being arrested. They never understood that. I couldn't announce it, of course. But I never wanted them arrested. These kids who came in the other day and tried to take over the office, police could have booked them all, and they had charges. But we just threw them out in the street without even asking their names. Because I didn't want them, no.
What about the injunction? Was that a fairly automatic procedure, or was it important to do it?
Well, it was important to do it, because otherwise you're making strikes for free. And that's against the law. I was going to uphold the law. And I was also going to show so-and-so's that after they'd done some committed violence, you know. They were doing violent things. There was violence going on, and I attributed it to the TAs. I couldn't prove it.
You mean some of the window breaking?
Window breaking and intimidation, threats, and the pistol shot into the tank.
I didn't hear about the pistol.
They fired a gun. Somebody fired a gun into a tank of ammonia over there. Could have killed somebody in the chemistry, outside the chemistry building. These are really pretty bad actors. A lot of things happen. I think it was worse than it appeared in the press. The violence was worse than that. And then the same people arguing later they should have used more of it. They're ruthless, completely ruthless.
Of course, that's where the democracy of the union worked, because there was a vote as to whether they would add violence, and they voted against it.
Yeah, but someone went and did it anyway. It was done anyway.
Hmm.
See, now, but you never know, of course, it could be by supporters who were not in the union.
Yes.
So one has to be careful about what it says about who did it, but the union didn't condemn it, the leadership didn't condemn it. And then they later went up to Minneapolis, and leaders did advocate violence.
Depending on what day it was.
You have to go back and look at the calendar and find out what happened on any given day. But remember, I had to worry about black students in this period, too. And worry about the kinds of things that led up to the bombing of Sterling Hall. I had a whole state of Wisconsin to worry about. Legislature.
And for them, for the state and the legislature, the TA strike was definitely an issue.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Well, it was important to me. I'm not saying it wasn't, but that things came on. There has been so many things in the years since then that I've thought about.
I suppose it's something the legislature could actually pin. I mean, they knew what a union was and where a strike against it. The decision about Cambodia was tremendous.
Yeah.
So you didn't worry about losing control
of what?
During the strike.
Well, I suppose I did. You see, you never know what's going to happen. The strike is a very big gamble. But what I was more worried about is that somebody would be killed or something. And I didn't want to strike.
Of what?
During the strike. Or did you?
Well, I suppose I did. You see, you never know what's going to happen. The strike is a very big gamble. But what I was more worried about is that somebody would be killed or something. And I didn't want to strike, but I believed that the strike was lesser evil than giving a place away. And, you know, no matter what concessions we'd given them, they were going to strike anyway, see? See, I've told Alan quite early, we're going to get a strike. I said, there's no way that you or I can prevent it. Because this is what that's what the leadership wants. They want a strike. Because their purposes are not bargaining purposes. It's not collective bargaining. Now he didn't want to believe that. But did he tell you I told him that?
The statement that you knew that you felt there was something more important than an agreement. That you couldn't just give everything away in order to.
Yes, and the other side of it is that the other side wanted to strike no matter what we gave them.
Yeah.
And the other thing in learning collective bargaining is promise things and then make concessions, then have a strike, and you're expected to give everything you promised even after the strike is settled. That's another aspect of collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is often a one-way street. The employer gives, the union takes.
That's, in this case, you didn't. You were.
I helped pull back. That's unusual.
Yes.
yes, I was. That was a great shock to some people.
Jim's turn, apparently. Well, I said that, but I'm quite puzzled. Nathan Fines here describes Jim's turn as having been extremely upset by the strike, by Marchetti, and by the hostility.
Well,
are you?
Well, Jim was upset. I think. See, Marchetti was one of Jim's favorite students. And Jim thought he had more influence, and he thought that to have his students behave so badly and also maybe to see such an aberration of collective bargaining, I don't know. But was he upset at me? Did that Nate's view?
No, not at you, but just at the students.
Yes.
And that they got to him. They knew he was a liberal.
Yes.
And he was
Sartre
and they
yeah. Yes, a lot of liberals got a rude awakening in these times.
But he didn't say that.
No.
That he was upset. And also.
Well, see, I didn't see. I maybe Nate misperceived. See, maybe by degree in terms of degree.
Mm-hmm.
Nate was very helpful, by the way.
Well, that's the next question.
Nate loves this university above all things, and he worked it. And Nate is the sort of person, if I said this is the bottom line, he'd work for settling with that bottom line. If he could pry something else out of me to get a settlement, he would. but he would always, Nate really believes in the same kind of university I do. Now, he'll give away the rest of the country to get a settlement, but NAEP is really, most of the time, believes settlement. He wants a settlement for a settlement's sake, and that's all right in collective bargaining when both parties want to survive. But NAEP, to support my position, really helped me very much. Like, you see, they could go see him and get to seek advice, and he would just tell them that, you know, you can't get beyond this. You'd be lucky to get as much as, you know, and you better take what you can get, and so on. But you see, the only time that there was any hope of settling with them was after they were beaten in the strike. They were losing the strike, and groups, departmental groups, were voting to go back when they then decided to call off the strike. Mm-hmm.
Department of TAs?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were, and that's where I made a decision not to destroy them as a union.
Yeah, that's what made for what I thought was a nice statement also, that he said you knew that you had to live with these people afterwards, so you didn't really want to just kill them all.
Partly that, and partly, I don't believe in raw power on either side. I don't like to win by much more than 52%. It's just my nature. I don't like rubbing people's faces. Just you know, it's nothing rational about it. It's just a stomach. I go by my stomach a great deal.
But so you did want him there, because I had understood that you hadn't wanted him to leave.
Nate?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to give him too much authority, but I used him a bit, and he helped some. But I didn't want to put him in. I've known Nate a very long time. After all, I was his straight man for him. We worked on the J.I. Case strike together. We worked on the construction strike here, and so. So I know Nate quite well. And sometimes his eagerness to settle when he's mediating is pretty great. I didn't want that to get carried away. And he was a good trooper, and he helped me anyway.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as having gotten them in, or TA as having gotten them in?
Well, I don't know. Knowing Nate, you'd be playing all sides.
He would have gotten
in. He couldn't, you know, just like a fire horse, he couldn't stay away. And they went to him, and I went to him, you see, because but I would normally discuss things with Nate anyway, because I knew he'd be seeing them, you see. And also, I trusted his advice, judgment, because, you see, I knew where his basic loyalty was to the university. And Nate was very fond of me too, personally, as I am of him. So I don't know in hindsight whether I did the right things or not. But see, so much I had to make decisions like that so many times, and they weren't calculated. There was a kind of instinctive way of going about it. Somebody goes back and really did a careful analysis and may come to the conclusion that I did the wrong thing from the beginning. I had to live with it, though. But that's the difference. That's another thing. You know, the person has to live with it. Has to be careful. One of the things that I've learned in some of these things is that whenever I've taken other people's advice and done something against my judgment and turned out to be wrong, then I really feel bad. But when I make up my own mind, get caught with it, then I don't feel so bad. I deserve it. But to have taken somebody's advice against my better judgment and then turn out to be wrong, then I really feel bad.
What was your father? What was your father's question?
Oh, yes. Well, my father was a fisherman. He died when I was 8. I had a very strong mother, Abel. I was born in Newfoundland, Labrador. I've been supporting myself since I was about 10, making my own living.
Oh.
Well, I worked on the farm. Then I earned money in the summer to go away to school, work my way through college.
What did your mother do? Did she work?
She remarried after 3-4 years, and I decided that I'd rather be independent.
Mm-hmm. Have you lived there at home?
No. We've been very close. I haven't lived with my mother since I was 10, 12 years old. Only for a short time.
You said she was very strong.
She had three children. I was the oldest to Newfoundland. Came to this country, got a job. Of course, her father had gone from Maine to Newfoundland, so it was that we had family ties. And she supported us, but she... So I didn't know my father well at all. He was away a great deal with the fishermen, and you know, they were always gone to sea.
Was she an educated person?
No. Her father was white, but she wasn't. Beyond the elementary school or primary school.
Was she religious?
Yes. Yes, she's religious. She's bothers her that I'm not. She's in a nursing home now. But she could do lots of things. I'm not like her, I suspect. She had great ability. She was a wonderful seamstress. She'd take a machine apart and put it back together again. She could do all kinds of things. She can't be more because of her. She had a stroke. But I don't think that. I think it bothered her that I was so independent. But she never did anything. She sympathized with it in a way, she kind of mixed up with it. So we didn't live together, we've been very close. Strange.
Well, I generally try to get people's backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does that for all I hope to do.
Yes, yes. I suspect in looking back, and I hadn't thought of it much, you know, I don't spend much time on this, the fact that I would insist on going my own way is that stubbornness that would lead me to take a strike rather than give it away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so you trusted to find somebody that came out. I am curious, was there any question of punitive action on?
Well, the question was whether we cared what we did about the injunction. You know, they were at suspended sentences, whether they should pay fines or not. We held that over them for about a year, and then we asked the judge to dismiss it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that was wise. Probably should have collected the fines.
I thought you did. I thought they paid $5,000.
Well, there were some cases we didn't. Some of them we got dismissed. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of them paid some, but I see. My view is Bob Fleming and I. You know, our friends, close friends for over many years. When Bob, you know, went down and bailed some of these people out, then I think it was Percy Julian, was his lawyer. When they got the bond money back, he mailed it to, and I'm not sure it was Julian, but I think it was one of our local activist lawyers. Instead of giving the money back to Fleming, he mailed it to the students he bailed out, and so Fleming never got his money back. Served him right, though. Bob says he bought. He was surprised. You know, he thought he was just helping them out, but you know, he didn't. There's some people. You know, this was one of the problems that some of Bill Sewell's friends had. They were advising Bill that these are just nice, gentle people, and just to you know, just make some concession, and they'll just be reasonable. They were reasonable. You know, this is a small group of people, a very small minority, who want disruption for its own sake and will carry it as long as they get away with it.
Well,
And Affleck would run a strike forever if he could. But when he had to, when they had to give up, when the pull out, the rug was pulled out from under him, he gave up. And would fight another day. But you, once, you know, you don't have to hate them. You don't have to beat them up. But you have to understand them. And that there are people like this. We have some people, we don't, this faculty, they never had very many of them on the faculty. We've had some few who were looking, always looking for some trouble somewhere. But very few. And then they change. The other thing is about the students, most of them get over it too, if you don't get them with a police record. But the police record is the thing that's the dangerous part. Because it bothered me during the black strike. The radicals who were supporting the blacks, making all the noise here, I'd be on an airplane with them. And I'd see them on the airplane all dressed up going east somewhere. So they can go away and forget the whole damn thing. They left the blacks out. This is a typical of, see, our radical kids tend to be upper class kids. They become advertising executives. And their parents did the same thing. One of the most interesting things, somebody didn't know it, is the number of our radicals who are the sons and daughters of the radicals of 30 years before.
I know, that's why I always ask them what their parents are, and they are.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And they're not, you know, they the parents have given them a guilt complex because they gave up the revolution and went into the advertising business. Or became psychiatrists in New York or psychologists. We had one black girl around here. She was screaming about the ghetto and all that, and their mother was a, and father were both practicing psychiatrists in New York and lived in the upper. I knew the address, you know. You get that kind of, so there's a fakeness about them.
I shouldn't say that. What I have found out is that their parents were liberals.
Yes.
I don't know
yeah.
Who turned out to be, at least they
had set. Yeah. Well, when they were students, they were doing the same kind of thing in the 30s. Some of them. Not all of them, of course, because you don't. But there are some of them. But it's so it's. But then they get. They mislead some other people who are serious, and they get them in trouble. And then But the thing about it is, and I'm still happy, that they can do these things here. And if they don't push it too far, they can go away and, at no cost. And this is why this is real redemption. You know, so and it's good. Because if there's ever a time for young people to be, for anybody to be radical, it's when they're young. I don't believe in law breaking. I believe in persuasion by argument, but anyway. But some of them are, we have some crazy ones too around. There's a handful right now. I'm using the word crazy, meaning that they're unbalanced people, and I'm afraid of them. Not for me personally, but I'm afraid that they'll do something desperate. That is, they're always in danger that they'll throw a bomb or do something like that, you know, or build a fire or do something.
What are they
saying? I'm talking about some undergraduates, but they get used by these the other radicals, you know, and they're the ones that get. Do the dirty work, and they're not balanced. They're having problems, and if you checked on them, you'd find out that some of them have been seeing psychiatrists pretty regularly. We had one of our radical students the other day try to jump off a building. One of the ones that goes with them, you see. Now many of them aren't all that. But there's a few of those, and that's another thing that worries me is how those people who are ill really are being used to some extent. And yet for others it's a release too. People have personal problems, you know. You mentioned two girls, what a great time they had. There was a letdown afterwards for them.
Yes, it was
something to live for. Yes, they identify with. One of the things that I've noticed, and other people have noticed too, that very homely or lied fat girls tend to get mixed up in with these things.
I'm
just now. That's not saying that all fat and homely girls do, but that it they get recognition for their activities. I know some of the pickets so well. Picketed my house. They picket for grapes. They picket for lettuce. They picket for. Yes. But I'm kind of fond of them all anyway. This they would never understand. would they?
No.
No, they had, I had to be the enemy, that was them.
Later on, and they did have the grace to say that Ed Prinsky had a sense of humor. Yeah. They liked him better than the president because he,
yes.
So they saw that.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you about whether you had any compunctions about ordering the faculty to report about their classes and to meet classes.
I have compunctions about ordering the faculty to anything, but sometimes you have to. You can't have it so that people can be on strike and get paid.
But it did cross your mind that maybe you were infringing on their autonomy.
I suppose it did. It would normally do it. So, but infringes on expecting to meet their own classes infringes on their liberties. Some faculty take a very strong view that we can't, that they're completely free to do anything they want to. But I don't believe it. They don't either, really. But you see, I couldn't do anything that the bulk of the faculty wouldn't accept.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
so, yeah, sure. They believe it. They would be resentful of their colleagues not doing it.
Mm-hmm. I guess the issue is that people felt that they would take responsibility for meeting their classes, but maybe not in their classroom, and resented being told that they might not.
Yeah, but
chastised.
You know. Mm-hmm. I suppose there was some. You know, sometimes I had to do things that some people didn't like. It's just the nature of things. But I probably would have made a pretty good estimate of how what I could do and couldn't do. I think, as I said earlier, I probably have a better ear for this than many people. I don't pay so much attention to the ones who are doing all the talking. You know, after all, my friend K.U. Smith, you know, it was going to sound off no matter what happened. And Anatole Beck's going to sound off, and Harvey Goldberg is going to go with the students, and some other people, you know, and I can name some others who always, you can count on them. And the students know that, and they laugh at them, and, you know, but they use them. And I can count on that. Now, sometimes the newspaper people and some others will say, well, everybody's saying it. Well, everybody isn't saying it. Everybody who's talking is saying it, but a lot of people aren't saying anything. And I can pick up the phone and call 25 people if I wanted to get a better sample. But that's just the business I'm in. But that might misfire. And then sometimes, I must admit, that if I thought it was the right thing to do, I'd do it anyway.
Everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't do that very often. But there's sometimes I do things.
You ever done it?
Yes. But I'm not going to say exactly. I wouldn't be likely to do it. I'd be very reluctant to do it. But if I thought it was that important, I would. For instance, the decisions to call the National Guard, I made them alone. I didn't consult anybody. I was going to keep this place open. But there was a rationale to it, again. Now, maybe you'd be interested in that. People don't understand. So many things right in front of them they never see. Under the law, as it was, first place, back up, in the 30s, the Pennsylvania state troopers were used for strike breakers. Therefore, when we got the state police in Wisconsin for the highway police, the labor people made sure that they couldn't have any law enforcement except patrol the highways. So we didn't have this. So the state police were not available, state troopers. The law provided that before you could get the National Guard, first you went to the city police, then to the county, and then to the contiguous counties. The contiguous counties have part-time volunteer deputy sheriffs, untrained, some of them not very fond of radical students at that time, if you can imagine. So, the only way you could get rid of those deputy sheriffs was to get the National Guard. I had to go through the routine, but
didn't you have to say, will you come? And what if they had said they would?
Who? They did come.
Oh, they did.
But the moment I got the National Guard, I had to send them home again.
Oh, Oh, I see.
See, the only way to get rid of, not
oh,
to,
I see.
See, yeah. The only way to avoid having the these untrained deputy sheriffs around with all the, was to get the National Guard quickly. The National Guard was wonderful. They stand out here and those girls would spit on them, spit in their faces. Oh, the women were just so, they behaved so bad to those radical women. I wanted to take them over my knee and spank them with a paddle. but they were bitter. The language was so foul. The women much worse than the men.
Yeah.
And the way those fellows stood and took it, they were just young fellows, same age. They behaved beautifully. We had one episode, the fixed bayonet episode. 300, a mob of 300 surrounded four or five of the soldiers, and they said, how can we frighten them away? And one of them said, let's fix our bayonets, that'll frighten them. And they did, and of course the TV cameras all took it, and we got fixed bayonets and all that stuff, but we stopped that. But that, now we got, that's all changed now, because the law got changed so that state troopers can protect the parks, the state parks.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that this is a state park?
No.
Maybe it is.
So now it's quite legitimate.
Yes. Yeah, so we wouldn't have a National Guard anymore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're saying, state troopers.
Yes.
Was that done for that purpose, so that they could be the ones to come?
Oh, I wouldn't think there'd be any relationship between the two things.
But besides, it's not likely to happen.
Never know what's going to happen. You know, if you get some thing that really outrages young people, the way the Vietnam War did, it'll happen again. Because, you know, it wasn't the radicals. If the radicals had been alone in that, it would have been very different. They had a lot of support from all kinds of students. So students are idealistic. And if they're outraged, they'll do something. And my job is to keep the university open.
I'd just like to ask you if you notice any difference in the TAA in the 70s.
Well, last time, I've seen very little of them, but I think they're more in the direction of collective trade unions.
And I don't know, are we getting near 10:30?
It's 10:10.
Oh. Yeah, all right, is that all you were going to say about
it? Yes.
How you would compare the crisis of the work stoppage in 1976 to 1970?
Well, they stopped for a couple of days, didn't they?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, I never took it very seriously.
It didn't
loom
in your mind,
did it? No, because you see, the students weren't going to support them. Students weren't, you see, they didn't have the Vietnam War thing, they didn't have the radical, all the other issues that were going on. So I never I didn't take it very seriously. Maybe I should have.
On the other hand, I guess the dean's office was very upset.
They're doing it, yes, but...
I mean, for the class size versus the
19.
Yes. Did this create a problem for you?
Yes, I had a problem. See, I always felt that TA shouldn't have as large classes as faculty members. I can do more with 40 students than I could with 15 when I first began. In some senses, I didn't like the fiction that the TAs had that the class size was really that. You see, by the end of the term, the classes were smaller, and there were some of them were just too lazy to correct papers, and so there were some of that. But most of the TA, we have a TA, we have a teaching award for teaching assistants, and. Two or three of the TA officers have gotten those awards. They are just tremendous. These awards didn't come because they were active in the TA. They came because of outstanding teaching. And they knew, when those people felt that the class was too large, I would tend to be sympathetic. Now, I don't happen to believe that all classes should be small, but if it's a discussion group, and if it's a particular language one, it's a drill. So and the dean's office was so worried about the budget. See, we were cutting their budget all the time.
Yes, remember. Of course, that was their big problem. Yes. So how do you balance that?
That's it, you see. Well, we balanced it by compromise, making them take somebody else's money.
You're talking 19s against 28s.
You know, but they didn't dream of 28. Now it's conceivable, you see, that in some place 28 would have been all right, but by and large it wasn't. So no, in the best place there would be no limitation, and a careful review of each course and class and arrive at in a reasonable way the size would be the best thing. But we aren't going to do that. There's no way of doing that. And because in the first place, the students always want to be at certain hours. And the policing of that is not a problem. And when the TA, when before we had a union, the TAs would agree to let them in. Because they'd say, well, look, I'm in your 7:45 section. I've got a breakfast job. Can I come at 9? And the TA would say yes. So there's no music. So we can't leave.
I bet they still do.
Well, I don't know. I suppose they do. But anyway, mm-hmm. It's interesting.
And Krinsky, did he leave because he wanted to? I forgot to ask him
about it. Oh, yes. He left because, see, he wasn't very happy at what he was doing because he wants to be a mediator, arbitrator, a middleman. He doesn't like being on one party. But he did it very well, but he didn't like it. And when he had this opportunity to get a lot more money to really do what he wanted to do and expand his arbitration, he'd become quite active in arbitration. You know, the FT, the TAs have tried to prevent him from being an arbitrator.
That's a nice story.
The other side, you know, I'm an arbitrator. I don't do it now, but I used to do quite a bit of it.
But he regarded himself, he said, in a way, as an arbitrator between you. He thought of himself as somewhat more lenient than you were.
Oh, yes. If it had been the other way, we would have lost everything. See, I couldn't say no and then let him drag me a little bit, and then that's where we'd arrive at.
But is that what was going on?
Oh, sure, it was always going on. I'd come down and say, hell, tell him no. And then he'd start arguing with me. See, I'd force him to lay out the case, but I always let him have his way. Didn't he understand that? In the end, but I made him argue it out, you see, and make him and convince himself that he really wanted to do it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, I gave him a great deal of leeway, at Krinsky, but I didn't make it easy for him to give something away.
But why was it so late on that work stoppage? If you remember, you agreed to the class size over by course at about 11 o'clock at night, and the students were all set for a work stoppage, whereas they say, and I rather think it may be right at this time, that if he had done it 2 days earlier, that they could have taken it and not had the work stoppage.
I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe I couldn't. I had to persuade that I had to get to live with the dean's office too. You know. See, sometimes in these things, you're in a situation where you may know exactly where you're going to come out. But you've got to carry people with you, and they've got to see that it's serious and that there is pressure, you see.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying it might have been, but you don't remember.
No. Because you don't.
I mean, even this was 1970.
I don't know. But for me to say I remember exactly would be untrue. And I'm not trying to avoid telling you.
No.
You understand that? Because, I can't remember the circumstances why we did it. Maybe, but probably, normally, it would be because I had to gauge the situation. I had to if I had made the decision earlier, say no, that would have looked as though I didn't give a damn what the dean's office thought. I was just digging it out.
Yeah, I know we're here. Does the TA emphasis on undergraduate teaching, has that caused you any trouble in the state? Because The implication has been that the university didn't care about undergraduate teaching.
It gets added to. See, this has been the line. I've been used to this. This is the line of some of the private undergraduate schools for years. We at one time had a president of Beloit who used to go around saying if the state would give them the money, they'd really teach the students the right way. Or some of them. One time there was a before merger. Somebody made some talk about that at their schools they have professors, and at Madison they have teaching assistants. So I made a list of all of their professors who were teaching assistants here that year because they were still trying to get degrees. Oh. So I'm used to that. Mm-hmm. But it didn't help any, you know, because people believe some. But and the news, you see, the establishment is always in a weaker position with news, because most of the news people are young people. Who tend to emphasize with these people and who print their statements.
Yes.
And they don't care whether they're true or not.
They print. It's very convincing. Too.
Yeah, yes, and they like to needle the establishment. So
yes.
This was more ammunition for that.
Mm-hmm.
But whether I put it very high on my list of things, I wouldn't have to worry about. But it wasn't good. It was another. These people were willing to hurt the university by misrepresenting. You see.
What is your opinion of the TAA? Is the significance of it on campus?
Oh, I don't think it's terribly significant.
And what is accomplished in terms of?
Well, it's made us much. I don't think it's improved teaching very much. It's insisted that we administer the contracts more carefully. I mean, the supervise the TAs more carefully. It has led some faculty members to stop using TAs altogether, which has saved us some money. And some of them, you know, have just stopped. They won't do it because they don't want to put up with the foolishness. It's put a one more bureaucratic, and it added to our costs by having people like, you know, Krinsky and others and so on. It's made life a little more difficult, a little more bureaucratic. And yet, we had somebody coming to us because there were some people who were unjust, loading on too much on the TA and so on.
It's given you quite a say in the department, hasn't it?
Yes,
and
it means
control some of it.
Yes, it means more centralization. You see, this is what unionism always means, centralization. This is why one of the reasons I'm so against collective bargaining for the faculty, because the decision making would eventually land up in the governor's office. That's where it has in New York State. Yeah, and in fact, it won't. See, so you treat everybody alike, which means great inequity, because people shouldn't be treated alike in the university.
Especially in the university. Well, I guess we'll stop here.
Okay.
But,
I.